I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump says he feels like a victim after a rough couple of weeks. He spoke about it on Wednesday, giving the commencement address at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
That evening, the Justice Department tapped former FBI Director Robert Mueller to be the special counsel investigating possible collusion between members of the Trump campaign and Russia. On Thursday morning, the president tweeted, "This is the single greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history." Also tweeted, "With all the illegal acts that took place in the Clinton campaign and the Obama administration, there never was a special counsel appointed." Later on Thursday, at a news conference with the Colombian president, Trump denied asking former FBI Director James Comey, whom he fired, to stop the probe of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and said this about the Mueller-led investigation.
Well, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero.
President Trump leaves today on his first foreign trip. We asked Jonathan Landay to join us. He's national security correspondent for Reuters. And Jonathan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Julian Zelizer, joining us from the studios of Princeton University, where he's a professor of history and public affairs, also a political analyst at CNN, co-host of the podcast Politics and Polls. And Julian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we could do a whole hour comparing, you know, which presidents were treated more unfairly than others. But Julian, as our historian for the hour, is he being treated more unfairly than other presidents?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's a long list of presidents who some are alive, like President Clinton, and others are not, who would argue they were subject to much rougher treatment without the same kind of evidence or concern about wrongdoing, serious wrongdoing, that exists in the current administration. Look, these investigations so far are driven by real evidence from intelligence agencies, from members of the administration, from President Trump himself with his tweets that go far beyond anything like a witch hunt.
To you, Jonathan, and I do want to talk about the story that you had yesterday, but I'm just curious about the response to naming former FBI Director Robert Mueller to be the special counsel. It seems like that has gotten unanimous support in Washington.
Yeah, it has. He's got a reputation as an upstanding investigator and prosecutor, and as head of the FBI, I believe the second and longest serving after J. Edgar Hoover. One of the things, though, that is curious is that we started hearing yesterday from leading Republicans hints that perhaps now that Mr. Mueller is driving the investigation by the Justice Department, that perhaps the congressional investigations, five congressional committees, no longer really have to move forward in the way they were because perhaps witnesses that they were going to call or preparing to call will no longer be prepared to testify in the opening Congress if they are, in fact, testifying are witnesses for Mr. Mueller's investigation. So there were hints of that. We'll have to wait and see whether or not that grows. I know that Democrats who are involved in these investigations believe that they should continue to go forward. And we'll have to wait and see whether or not, in fact, there is a friction over this idea that, in particular, this applies to the former director of the FBI, Mr. Comey, whom I know at least three congressional committees want to talk to, both in open and closed session, whether or not, and since he now figures at the center of all this, whether or not he is, in fact, going to be able to testify at all in the open before Congress.
Julian, is it possible to have, as Jonathan just said, five congressional investigations? You've got Mueller doing a criminal probe. Is it possible to do all of this without stepping on everyone else's toes?
Absolutely. Look, in many of the major scandals, Watergate, Iran-Contra, you had independent prosecutors or special prosecutors working on their own line of investigation, while Congress, often in the end more centralized through some kind of select committee, conducted an investigation of its own. The congressional investigation, it's different. It's much broader about Russian intervention in the election, not just looking at potential criminal wrongdoing within the administration. And just as important, it's public. Congressional hearings are important because people see and hear from all the figures involved. It is difficult. Mueller will probably not want to have some people testify in public, but I actually think it's important that both are conducted, and we've done this before. It's nothing new.
Did we do this during Watergate, for instance?
We did. Absolutely. We had famously special prosecutors trying to work on this investigation, often as the president resisted and in 1973 fired Archibald Cox in the Saturday Night Massacre. But you also had a select committee by Sam Ervin, which had hearings that were really important, I think, for the public to understand just what was going on with this White House, not simply criminal acts versus non-criminal acts, but what was the tenor, what was the environment that President Nixon had allowed. And so I think we did it then, and I think we can do it again now.
Let me play something that Senator John McCain said to CBS's Bob Schieffer. This was at a dinner on Tuesday.
I think we've seen this movie before. I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale and a couple of other scandals that you and I have seen. It's a centipede that the shoe continues to drop. And every couple of days, there's a new aspect of this really unhappy situation.
Jonathan Atlande, it seems that all stories or most stories seem to lead to Michael Flynn. You had a story yesterday in Reuters. Michael Flynn and other advisors to Donald Trump's campaign were in contact with Russian officials and others with Kremlin ties in at least 18 calls and emails during the last 7 months of the 2016 presidential race. What can you tell us about even the content of these contacts?
So it's our sources were telling us that they know that there were at least 18 contacts, calls, emails, texts during the last 7 months of the campaign between, as you just read, yeah, Trump aides and campaign aides and associates and Russian officials and others with ties to the Kremlin. But there were also, as we write in the story, contacts after the election between Mr. Flynn or General Flynn and the Russian ambassador to Washington, Sergei Kiselyak. The pre-election contacts, we were told, focused mainly on discussions about cooperating in Syria against the Islamic State, about righting or repairing U.S.-Russian economic relations. And as we know, those have been hit very hard by sanctions that were imposed by the Obama administration for a variety of reasons spanning from Crimea to what the U.S. intelligence community has concluded was Russian interference in the U.S. election. And this was a little bit surprising to us, but talking about perhaps cooperating on containing a surging China. And then the post-election discussions between General Flynn and Ambassador Kiselyak, we are told, focused on the possibility of creating a back channel between President Putin and President Trump, a direct line of communication that could circumvent the U.S. national security establishment. Both sides looked upon the U.S. intelligence community obviously with deep suspicion. Remember President Trump going to the CIA, but also accusing the intelligence community of acting like Nazis. Hmm. And of course, both the Defense Department and the intelligence community vehemently opposing the exploration by former Secretary of State John Kerry of the possibility of cooperating with Russia in fighting the Islamic State in Syria. And so whether or not, you know, that came to be, the establishment of this back channel, we don't know. But those are what we essentially understood to be the subjects broadly.
Of discussions between Flynn, I guess, and others, and their Russian contacts in that country. Julian, what do you make of that?
Well, I think there's clearly many connections and discussions that Flynn was having, which are at the heart of the problem, at least on the surface. My guess is that the deeper that the investigators dig, there might be other connections from what we're hearing that are also problematic. It's not simply – like the question is, will Mike Flynn be like Oliver North in Iran-Contra? Will he be the point person? Will he become the focus of the story? Or is this broader? And there's also simultaneous investigations into financial elements of the connections, which seem different than what we're discussing. And we don't know as many details about what the investigators are looking for in Treasury records, but there are that element of the investigation and the connections as well, meaning financial.
Julian, is it hard?
Marty,
yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
Important. I think it's important to put a couple of things in perspective here. None of our sources said they had heard or were aware of from these contacts any evidence of collusion between Trump campaign aides and associates and the Russians, nor did they see any evidence that President Trump himself was aware of or authorized these contacts. But let's not forget that initially the White House denied, and this was, among others, Vice President Pence, denied any connections between campaign aides, associates, and the Russians, and then eventually they had to admit to four. Now, in this case, we have 18, at least 18 and more after the election, and it's important to note that veterans of political campaigns that we have talked to, veteran campaign advisors, said it's natural for to have contacts between campaigns and foreign diplomats, but they are limited, and the number that we have come up with is quite exceptional. Another thing that the count that we have in our story does not include is that we reported a couple of hours after the Washington Post broke the story, they beat us by a couple of hours, that on the day that former President Barack Obama sanctioned Russia for its what the intelligence community says is this interference in the American election and expelled more than 30 alleged Russian intelligence agents, spies, in other words.
You know what, Jonathan? Hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break and I don't want to cut you off midstream. That's Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Reuters. Also with us, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Reuters' Jonathan Landay, Princeton University's Julian Zelizer, about the rough week for the White House. And you can join our conversation. You can text or call our comment line. It's 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Jonathan, do you remember where you left off?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead. That's
right. So we reported that day there were five telephone calls between General Flynn and the Russian ambassador to the United States. And during the period of those calls, that those calls covered, the Russian reaction to President Obama's sanctions went from one of fury to later that day where Russian President Putin said he was not going to take any kind of retaliatory action. Subsequently, it was reported that in those calls, two of them discussed sanctions, or the U.S. sanctions on Russia, something that Vice President Pence had insisted he was told was not the case by Mike Flynn, and all of that eventually led to Mike Flynn's dismissal by the president, or at least those were the grounds that were cited. So we're talking about extensive conversations in our story or context, but they did not include that additional five calls that day.
Well, Julian, let me pick up on a couple of things. I mean, contact is not necessarily equal collusion. Is collusion hard to prove?
Yes. So let me start by saying we do have contacts during campaigns between members and representatives from overseas. That's not the first time this has happened. I think this case is about contacts, A, within a massive effort by the Russians, from what we know, to intervene in the election. That's the context we have to remember and why the contacts are of concern, and an intervention that leaned toward one party over the other. It's not clear that these are contacts with any kind of plan, discernible foreign policy plan. And I think that's another reason the story keeps moving forward. And then third, there's a credibility problem for this administration. As we just heard, there has been many contradictions and lies about what kind of contacts existed, when they existed, from within the administration itself. And so I think that's why members of Congress aren't quite comfortable when they hear explanations about why this was going on. And I think that's how this has turned into something that might be familiar into an investigation.
Well, this seems the perfect time then to bring in Mara Lias, and she's national political correspondent for NPR. And Mara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
What's the mood in the White House these days? They've had a rough couple of weeks.
Yeah, they've had a rough couple of weeks, and it's been difficult and frustrating, and you can see the president expressing his frustrations and feeling he's been a victim here. A lot of the staff at the White House are trying to figure out a way to compartmentalize this. This is the advice that they get from other White Houses who've gone through these special counsel investigations. Try to designate one or two people who deal with this, obviously the White House counsel,
right.
But also try not to get consumed by it and see if you can turn the spotlight back to the president's legislative agenda. That's been hard because the president doesn't seem to want to do that.
Well, I was going to say, it seems that the president is consumed with this, maybe for obvious reasons, certainly looking at his Twitter storm.
Yes, and you know what's so interesting is when he put out the statement after Mueller was named, it was pretty restrained for him. He once again asserted his innocence, but everybody was wondering, would that be it? He could have just praised the appointment, saying, I'm looking forward to getting this resolved, now we're going to move on, and he could have refused to talk about it anymore, say, look, as long as it's under investigation, I'm not going to discuss it, but he didn't do that. And the question is, if there's no smoking gun or even a body yet, why is he acting like he has something to hide? You know, the cliche is it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. Here it's one step removed. He's creating the appearance of a cover-up.
Well, we have been playing some clips before you came on, and I quoted a couple of the president's tweets. Let me just make sure you know that Jonathan Linde is with us, national security correspondent for Reuters. Also with us, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, just so you know who you're on with.
Yes, I'm in very good company.
You are in very good company, absolutely. And I have just a trillion questions here. But let me go back to you, Jonathan, and I played a clip of the president speaking yesterday when he was with the Colombian president, and he seemed to separate himself from other members of the Trump campaign that is under some kind of investigation, basically saying, I can only speak for myself. I don't want to read too much into it, but do you see any significance in that?
Well, I think a lot of people picked up on that, and the question is, you know, was he drawing a line between himself and other aides and associates in the campaign? Certainly, some people read it that way. They look at, and you know, there has been some reporting that or profiles of President Trump, and you know, that question whether or not he has ever taken the blame for anything that has gone wrong, whether it was in his private business or as his short stint now as president.
Let me go to, yeah, go ahead, Mara, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, he has made a lot of comments talking about the fact that he personally is not a target. That's what he said in his letter firing Comey. You've told me three times I am not under investigation. And he's reported to have asked for that reassurance. So he definitely is very focused on whether he himself, not Carter Page, not Paul Manafort, but whether he himself is a subject of this investigation.
Well, Julian, let me go back to you. And I'm thinking,
hold on.
I got three great guests here. Let me go back to you, Julian. I'm thinking, of course, of Watergate and Nixon's tapes. President Trump said that he has tapes of conversations or a conversation that he had with James Comey. Could that be something that Mueller, the special counsel, could ask for?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if President Trump is aware, but that would all be public material. That's one of the aftermaths of the revelation of those Nixon tapes. And we don't know there. I don't really know what that comment meant. It was, I think, in quotations.
It was.
But if there are recordings, certainly I think members of Congress, and we've heard both parties talk about this, would want to hear what those tapes have to say. You know, ironically, he might have revealed something that is even more incriminating about what happened. But that's been part of the dynamic. He's often getting himself in more trouble because of these tweets as they go on. And I would say the comment that he separates himself yesterday from members of his cabinet could or his campaign could set up an interesting dynamic in that, again, back to Watergate, one of the important things that happen in the congressional hearings are members of the administration start to speak, and they start to speak more honestly. And members might have heard that comment, and they might be getting nervous that he is going to throw them under the bus. And that's when people start to speak. So once again, that comment might set up a dynamic that's dangerous for him, even though he's trying to protect himself, it sounds like.
Well, Mara, I'm curious about how this is all playing out among Republicans. I mean, we certainly are hearing some of them being a little more critical of the president, but it seems he has created problems for his party.
Huge problems, huge problems. Republicans are in a panic right now. They're not quite sure where all this is going to go. How much is it going to undermine their ability to pass tax cuts and Obamacare replacement? They're worried about 2018, whether it's going to either destroy completely or at least eat into the majority in the House of Representatives. I mean, this is a really difficult time for Republicans. They knew what they were getting into, but I think they had a bit of magical thinking. A lot of people in Washington have this, including Democrats.
Right.
We can get into that later.
Right, yes.
But the idea that once he became president, he could be managed. There would be structures put into place in the White House. And for a while, that seemed, at least in the foreign policy arena, that that was happening. He appointed good people. They managed to walk back some of the more incendiary things he said about NATO, but that's not happening now. And I think Republicans are very, very worried, but it's really difficult for them to break with the president because the Republican hardcore base is solidly behind him, and those are the people who vote in primaries.
Martin, this is a little bit of a sidebar question, but I thought it was interesting that the president thought that the Democrats would be pleased that he fired Comey. He said, you know, they've said terrible, horrible things about Comey when he was investigating Hillary Clinton's server. I was just surprised. I was surprised that he was surprised.
Shocked. That is the most mystifying, one of the many mystifying things about this whole episode is just, and this goes to basic political competence. I mean, why the White House thought that either the Democrats would be happy that Comey was fired, or at least they'd look so hypocritical if they complained about it that the White House could attack them on that. The same thing when they floated Joe Lieberman as the new FBI director. He once was a Democrat. Well, sure, but a lot of things have happened since then. And Democrats are saying, no way. You know, there's a tremendous bad blood between Democrats on the Hill and Joe Lieberman. So they don't seem to have very good political antenna.
That's Mara Liasson, national political correspondent for NPR. Also with us, Princeton University political science and history professor Julian Zelizer and Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Reuters. We are talking about what many people are talking about this week, which is, to put it sort of crassly here, the president's no good, very bad week. You can join our conversation, text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Jonathan, let me go back to you. And when you read about Michael Flynn, the relationship with the Trump campaign, the Trump interim team, and then the Trump administration, there are just so many questions about why the president, even to this day, seems to continue to defend him, apparently gave him a kind of attaboy a couple of not so long ago when he has been under investigation. Do you understand this relationship?
I do not. And you're right. And one of the things we need to point out is that apparently the president was aware that Mr. Flynn, or General Flynn, was under investigation regarding his representation of foreign governments, or taking particularly a failure to register as a foreign agent to promote the views of the Turkish government, when the president decided to bring him on as his national security advisor. He was also warned by his predecessor, Barack Obama, that perhaps he should rethink the idea of bringing General Flynn on as a national security advisor with access to the very most secret intelligence and policies of the United States. Following his dismissal as the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2014, his appearance on Russia Today at a gala, Russia Today being the propaganda mouthpiece of the Russian government, at a gala at which he was pictured sitting next to President Putin and taking money for that, and also taking money from a Turkish-American businessman to represent the viewpoints of the Turkish government. All of this under investigation, both by the FBI as well as the Department of Defense Inspector General's office, because General Flynn's company did not register as a foreign agent until did it retroactively after it took all this money and represented General Flynn appears not to have reported taking this money to the defense or obtained the permissions that he was told by the Defense Department when he left DIA he would have to get from both the Defense Department and the State Department to take money from foreign governments. He apparently appears to have ignored that advice and is in deep appears to be in very deep trouble as a result.
What do you make of that, Julian?
Well, in terms of the relationship, I think it will come down to one of two options. One is that relationship after Flynn's very important role in the campaign as a bulldog, so to speak, going after Hillary Clinton in the convention and thereafter on the email issue, that it's kind of chaos and sloppiness and President Trump just liked him and appreciated what he was doing and didn't really check and ignored all these warnings that were going on and was just steadfast in keeping him on the team. And the other option is equally troubling, if not more troubling, is that he knew all along and this was fine with him because it was part of a bigger pattern within the administration. I mean, I think that's what members of Congress and the special counsel are going to be looking into. But we don't really know why he stayed there and then why there were these just repeated denials of what was going on, which makes it look that much more suspicious. But, you know, there's an element of Donald Trump that we just don't understand. How much of this is unscripted chaos and this style, which doesn't make it any better, and how much of this is deliberate and strategic? And those are the two President Trump's people are trying to figure out which one is it. For some people, neither is a better option, really.
Well, Mara, you cover the administration, you cover Congress, the White House, President Trump. How do you see him? And what is it like to cover him?
Well, it's like, I think it's just a more intense version as consuming the news about him. In other words, you know, it's like you're in the White House, you're preparing a story at 4:30. It's almost like clockwork. 4 or 5 p.m., something big blows up, and you run upstairs to see what the press secretary is going to say about it. But, of course, they just found out about it, too. So they're huddling and deciding what their story is going to be, and they say something, and then a couple hours later, the president, or the next morning, the president contradicts them in a tweet. It's very chaotic. It's an undisciplined place, even though there are a lot of good people working very hard in the White House. It's extremely difficult. I covered Bill Clinton's White House, which was pretty, at that time, notoriously undisciplined and freewheeling.
Right.
This, nothing compares to this.
And is that because of the president?
Yes. Every White House takes on the personality of the president and his concerns, and in this case, his grievances. And the president's personality sets the tone for the White House. Barack Obama, very calm, no drama, very closely held. The joke was three people run the whole government. but, you know, Donald Trump, all drama, all chaos all the time. The opposite.
And now,
it's so interesting because voters usually correct for the previous president. In other words, they corrected George W. Bush by getting Barack Obama, very different person. They seem to have overcorrected this time.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I know, Julian, you want to add something. We are talking about this week in White House news. That's Mara Liasson. She's national political correspondent for NPR. Julian Zelizer, a Princeton University professor, also joining us as well. And Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Reuters. And again, you can join our conversation, much that we are covering this morning. Call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Can you keep up with all this news? You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jonathan Lande, Julian Zelizer, and Mara Liasson about the rough week for the White House. President Trump saying earlier this week that no politician in history has been treated worse or more unfairly. He's leaving today for his first foreign trip. And again, you can join our conversation. Text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. Let me play something that Senator Lindsey Graham said yesterday. He was speaking to reporters following a Senate briefing from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
I think the shock to the body is it's now considered a criminal investigation, and Congress's ability to conduct investigations of all things Russia has been severely limited, probably in an appropriate fashion. So I think a lot of members want the special counsel to be appointed, but don't understand that you're pretty well knocked out of the game. And that's probably the way it should be. It was a counterintelligence investigation before now. It seems to me now to be considered a criminal investigation.
And again, that was Senator Lindsey Graham speaking yesterday. Let me toss this out, and Julian, I'll start with you. It is interesting, while so much coverage of the problems that the Trump administration has been having, that his supporters are largely standing by him. They don't like it when we do programs like this because I hear from them. What do you make of that? And how important is that, do you think, for the president himself?
Well, look, his support throughout the campaign came from people who liked his message. They liked what he had to say, and they liked his framing himself as a person who was taking on the political and economic establishment of the country. So there is no reason to think that as they watch these investigations take place, that many supporters will see this as part of the same narrative. This is that rigged system trying to take out their president. I don't think that their loyalty in general will be hurt by the news that's coming out. That said, there are many Republicans on Capitol Hill whose constituency is either much broader in the Senate or that isn't simply Trump-based supporters. And until now, partisanship has protected President Trump in many ways because Republicans have remained loyal to the party and hoping their agenda moves. But I think this week, for the first week, you started to see some cracks in that partisan firewall. And I think that's where the president gets himself in a dangerous situation. Even if that base remains very loyal, other parts of the party could start to fear, what will the consequences of this be in 2018? Will we lose control of the House and Senate? And also 220.
We're talking 220 already.
They're going to start thinking, if this is the president we have, what's going to happen in 220? And that's where I think some tensions emerge that are problematic for the administration politically.
I mean, and Mara, you covered the presidential campaign and people that voted for Trump. They did it for a myriad of reasons, but some of them wanting jobs. They want a better health care system. They want to pay less taxes. Are those things on the back burner with all this controversy?
Well, there's definitely when the president is distracted in this big league way, there's definitely a threat to his agenda, and that's what Republicans on Capitol Hill worry about. Health care, taxes, all the things they promised their voters, they need to deliver, especially because they now have control of the entire government. And there's no doubt, as Julian said, that there is some portion of his hardcore base that will never abandon him no matter what. We don't know where his floor is yet. Is it 37%, 38, 40? We're not sure. Mm-hmm. But those people are not going to disappear. However, he has lost support among a certain number of his voters who didn't just vote for him because he was going to give the middle finger to the establishment, but because they took him seriously and they believed that he would bring back their manufacturing job or cut their taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So those people, I think, are where he's suffered his loss in approval ratings. But the interesting thing now, and I agree with Julian, this week was a kind of tipping point on Capitol Hill. You do see cracks emerging. You do see Republicans really starting to panic about what Donald Trump might do to their agenda, their reelection prospects, et cetera. And you have a lot more attention paid to Vice President Pence, who has set up a super PAC of his own before earlier in the cycle than any other vice president in history. And he always was the kind of ultimate break glass insurance policy for Republicans. Most Republicans, if you talk to them privately, would have rather had President Pence than President Trump. So there's going to be a lot of attention paid to the vice president now. And he's hip deep in the investigation because he, of course, says he didn't know these things about Flynn, even though he was the head of the transition, and he said many things that were the opposite of what Donald Trump has said to describe these contacts with Comey and the Justice Department.
Let me play a caller, and as I mentioned, Trump supporters are often critical when we do programs like this. Let's hear from Melanie.
My name is Melanie. I'm from Reading, Pennsylvania. I just wanted to let you know that Donald Trump knows what he's doing. He is hanging you all out to dry, including the press and every member of Congress, showing us, the American public, what you people are all about. You have no support out there. You are trying to drum it up, and you're not going to get it. His base will stick with him till the day he dies. You could have another election 2 weeks from now, and he will still be our president. He is so right in draining the swamp. You are giving him enough rope to hang yourself, and that's what this is all about.
Jonathan, I just speak here. As I said, we've had that before, and he absolutely is our president. There's no question about it. It seems we're all allowed to criticize a president if they seem to be doing things that are not what they had promised to do. But, Jonathan, what do you make of that?
I don't cover media matters. So it's hard for me to comment, but I would just point out that the subscriber base for print media, which had taken such a huge hit between 2006, 2007, and last year in terms of dropping subscribers and having to close and newspapers closing, the subscriber base for both the Washington Post, the New York Times, and I believe the Wall Street Journal are all up. And all of this is being attributed to their coverage of the president. I'm not sure what your caller means by setting us all up.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the idea that that we are going to be shown, our coverage is going to be shown to be inaccurate, I don't see that, simply because just pointing to one example, the reports that began about contacts between campaign aides and associates and Russians with connections to the Kremlin were initially rejected by the White House. It then had to come back and say, well, actually, yes, there have been acknowledged four of them. As for the story that I reported yesterday about much more extensive contacts than were previously known, there has been no denial at all from this White House.
And we're just about out of time here. Julian, I've been on the air for 30 years, so we certainly have heard from critics of previous presidents and supporters of previous presidents. But what I hear from a lot of Trump supporters is that their president can do absolutely no wrong. Even the most ardent supporters of President Obama seem to say there were things he did that they did not agree with. But this kind of ardent passion coming from Trump supporters seems different to me.
Well, it is very intense. It's very strong. And he is going to test that support. We have to remember, much of the country isn't happy with him. His approval ratings nationally are not good. And so there is a disconnect with the base. And I would say that even if the base is passionate about him, even if his support is very strong in the communities that voted for him, that's really irrelevant to the investigation that journalists, Congress, and a special counsel have to conduct. If there is corruption in the White House, if there was corruption in the campaign, it's not about a popularity or approval ratings or subscriptions. It's about finding out whether the democracy is healthy. And so I think it's a separate conversation. And maybe he's setting everyone up.
Sure.
But look, rationally right now, he's not doing what he wanted to do. We have no legislation out of this White House. None. No significant legislation, and none of the campaign promises, almost none of them, have been put into effect. So if this is a successful president, a happy president, it's certainly a very different image of success than we've seen in the past.
Mara, let me give you just a quick response, if you could, and then we're going to have to say goodbye to all three of you.
My only response to Julian is, he's had a big effect. He hasn't passed legislation, but Donald Trump has changed a lot of things already, and I think Democrats would be deluding themselves to say, oh, now he's just stuck. You know, he's trapped and paralyzed by this investigation. Look, the fact is that legal immigration, applications to universities from foreign students, you know, people are not coming here. If you're a smart Indian engineer, you want to go to Vancouver, not Silicon Valley. That's the Donald Trump effect, and that's what he wanted to do, and he succeeded in that. And I could go down a whole long list. So, yes, he hasn't passed legislation, but he's having a big effect on the country even without that.
NPR's
And whether it's good or bad is you know,
time
you
will
can
tell.
Decide that for yourselves. Yeah.
Mara Liasson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Julian Zelizer, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Lande, appreciate you joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Well, we want to see how all this is playing out in Russia. And joining us now is Amy Ferris Rotman. She is Moscow correspondent for foreign policy. And she's been writing about the fact that the news from Washington, I should say, has kept comedians and satirists quite busy. And Amy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be with you.
How much interest in all the back and forth that's been happening in Washington over the last couple of weeks? How much interest in Russia?
In Russia, I can say it's consumed public and unpublic life. Russians are completely obsessed with the goings-on in Washington, both at the official level and at the unofficial level, and we're seeing an enormous amount of parody and humor coming out of Russia in response to it. I would say they're almost reveling in a sort of triumphalism about what's going on in Washington and how bad President Trump is appearing.
Really? What's the humor about? What's the parody about?
We've seen it on the official level. We've seen Lavrov, the foreign minister, quipping to American journalists recently that he didn't know the former FBI director James Comey was fired. And he kind of joked the journalists and said, "Was he fired? You're kidding." President Vladimir Putin has done similar, saying, his firing won't affect relations, and then kind of encouraged the journalists to go play ice hockey with it. Mm. And then we're seeing it on the unofficial level as well. Comedy shows, TV shows, and theaters are beginning to have Trump impersonators and show him in a very unflattering light as someone who can't handle the presidency, who can't handle his job that he's been given, essentially.
Well, it sounds like late-night TV or TV in Russia is not unlike late-night television in the United States with all the comedy shows.
Exactly. It is very similar, in respect to Saturday Night Live, except for I think there is one difference, which it's very jeering and very mocking in Russia. Trump is portrayed increasingly as someone who's out of touch with his people, with America, but also he's being represented and shown as a failure, which, of course, Cold War in Russia hasn't really ended. I mean, obviously it did end officially 25 years ago, but Russians are still smarting from that. There's an enormous amount of resentment in Moscow and in Russia by ordinary people and by the government about how the Cold War ended. And so to watch the sort of unraveling of what they see as democracy is it's a source of pride, I would say, for some Russians.
How would you say, and is it possible to know, how Vladimir Putin views Donald Trump? I mean, certainly the president has been quite praising over the last couple of years of Putin. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, this is a kind of a bromance that died before it could even get off the ground. But, I mean, it remains to be seen. I think that we don't know what their relationship is really like. It doesn't seem to be as solid as we had thought it would be when he was campaigning and then won the election. But I also think there's genuine disappointment in Russia. They obviously wanted Putin. They obviously wanted Trump. They backed Trump. We know that. That was all out in the open. But I don't know if they're really as much as they're enjoying the chaos which is going on in Washington, I'm not sure that things are going as well as they had hoped. I mean, I do think that Putin did want to have some sort of genuine good relationship with Trump as opposed to Obama. The relationship with President Obama deteriorated severely during that administration.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, though, I'm thinking of that photograph earlier in the week. I believe it was Monday in the Oval Office with the foreign minister, with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. And, you know, they looked like they were thoroughly enjoying themselves.
They really did. And I mean, to be a fly on that wall, I would have give my left arm. But I mean, yeah, I think they were enjoying themselves. And I think there's something else that we have to all remember is that the Russians are extremely good at foreign policy and intelligence, sharing and collecting, probably the best in the world. I mean, I would dare say. And so I think a lot of the smiles there, they knew that their state run news agency photographer was there. They knew exactly what they were doing. And I think a lot of it was triumphant laughter.
Well, Amy Farris-Rotman, we're going to have to call you up again. Just a short interview with you today. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thank
you. And you're welcome. Moscow correspondent for foreign policy. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. You can sign up for a newsletter, and you can also listen to us on NPR's satellite channel. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.